Our next case is 13-91 and 13-203, First Merit Bank versus Daniel E. Inks et al. For the appellant, Mr. Warren.
Chief Justice, Justices, 153 years ago, this court, in a building not far from here, in what is now the Speaker's office and the State House, this court, all five members of it, were presented with the precise proposition that is before the court today. And that is whether or not the enforceability of an oral agreement hinges upon the procedural posture in which it is raised in the case. And in that case, the argument was made, as here, that because the oral agreement was attempted to have been asserted as a defense to an action, as opposed to in a complaint or the equivalent of it at the time, that the statute of frauds should not apply. And this court said, such a distinction, so far as we know, has never been recognized. And so in 1860, in Finch versus Finch, this court ruled that the statute of frauds applied whether or not the oral agreement was asserted in the form of a complaint, a counterclaim, a defense, or whatever it might be. And this was not an aberration at the time. In fact, that was followed by this court's decision in Reinheimer versus Carter in 1877, in which this court echoed that decision and said that a defendant who wanted to plead the existence of an agreement had to plead that it was in writing. And when this court did so in 1877, it referred to a case of its own, if you can believe it, that had come out 200 years before that. And that was the case that we had submitted to your honors, Case versus Barber, which we submitted to you because if you look at Reinheimer versus Carter, this court's decision from 1877, it actually doesn't say when Case versus Barber is from. So I thought I would tell you. The statute of frauds and perjuries was passed by Parliament in 1677, 200 years before Reinheimer. In 1681, only 4 years after the statute of frauds was passed, this precise issue was presented to the King's Bench. Not surprisingly, an able lawyer at the time attempted to make this very argument. And the King's Bench rejected it and said, in essence, that the defendant is not allowed to take away the plaintiff's claim and not give him another on which a claim could be pleaded. So in essence, if an oral agreement could be used as a defense, but it couldn't be used to assert it as a claim or a counterclaim, then it could be used to defeat a written agreement. And what you would be left with is an oral agreement that neither party could sue on.
Was there an oral agreement? Was there an oral agreement?
Well, there's a dispute between the parties. First Merit contends that there was no agreement. The 60B folks in this case argue that there was. I would note that there had been three written forbearance agreements in this case, each of them saying that any modification of it had to be in writing. These were sophisticated parties. They signed each of those written forbearance agreements. Each one of them was defaulted on. In the days before the auction in this case, there were communications that are in the record, both parties indicating that they were working toward getting an agreement that had to be in writing again. You know, so one of the things about the statute of frauds that's so compelling is that the parties understand that for an agreement to be enforceable, it had to be in writing. Now, if the enforceability of that agreement hinged on whether or not it was asserted offensively in a complaint or defensively in a defense, it would be completely illogical, and people would be encouraged to wait, I suppose, until somebody else sued, until the other party
sued. Well, counsel, isn't the argument being made here that, well, we had a forbearance agreement, and here's the evidence, you took my money. You took my money, and you didn't enforce the foreclosure. Isn't that the argument that's being made here? That the actions of the bank established the existence of the oral agreement.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that there certainly was no money that changed hands. I mean, there was an effort, you know, because there had been three forbearance agreements already that had been defaulted on in this case, and because...
And those forbearance agreements were in writing.
They were. And because there had been an attempt to foreclose on the property, a sale, and then Ashland Lakes had declared bankruptcy, so that had stayed it. Needless to say, the bank was not excited about the prospect of going through this again, so they had required some earnest money.
Sure.
And they hadn't come up with the earnest money by that point. They were arguing that they didn't have to come up with this much earnest money, but this is precisely the point of why you need the statute of frauds, because you don't want to get into a he said, she said situation about something involving lands. And this court, you know, this court has said time and again in Olympic Holding and in Heaton and cases that go way back, you know, the purpose of the statute of frauds is to prevent frauds and perjuries. And so it has always been interpreted that way. I see I have about 9:30 left. I'll take 3 minutes for rebuttal if I can. So the argument that has been made in response to this is sort of a plain language argument, right? The argument is no action shall be brought means no action shall be brought. Interestingly, this argument was rejected by this court 150 years ago or so, and not even Ashland Lakes made this argument in this case. This is such a settled principle of Ohio law that this argument was not even raised until the Ninth District raised it sua sponte. And perhaps if the Ninth District had had the benefit of briefing on the issue, we would not be in the position that we're in today, which is that we could have alerted the Ninth District not only to the fact that its decision conflicted with the Tenth District in other cases, but also that this court had already reached this issue and rejected the proposition that is before the court today. So really, the Ninth District's case here is a complete outlier. There, so far as we know, there is no other case in Ohio history, and then if you reach back to the King's Bench, 350 years in which this decision has been made. Now, if this court decides to do a textual analysis of it, I would suggest that there are several principles that this court has articulated that should guide its result. First of all, this court, Section 1.42 of the Revised Code says that when a statute has adopted a particular meaning, that this court should interpret it as such. This is the way this language has been interpreted for 350 years. Second of all, Your Honor?
I'm just, you know, thinking about the sequence of what happened while the fourth forbearance agreement was being negotiated. In this day and age, you know, they're talking about here's the bank's proposal, here's the counteroffer, changing the amount of money owed, and et cetera, and then there's telephone negotiations. You know, in light of faxes and emails and everything else that the banks and lawyers and everybody has at their disposal, to say that this fourth agreement could not have been reduced to writing almost instantaneously had there been an agreement reached over the telephone practically makes little sense to me.
Well, and Your Honor is quite right. I mean, today it's very easy to memorialize an agreement in writing, and frankly, both of the parties in this case were well aware of the necessity of doing that if they were going to have a binding agreement. Now, to be fair, going back 350 years, if you wanted to have an agreement in writing, that was a chore. You know, and so with the advent of computers, this is not a difficult hurdle for parties to meet. And so it's certainty for parties here. And if the principle, remember the principle that's being argued here by Ashland Lakes, by the Inks and the Slimans, is that they could assert this as a defense, but they concede they can't assert it as a counterclaim. So think about that strange conundrum. It's why we argued in our briefs that the 60B was more in the nature of an action, because they were seeking through the 60B to assert a counterclaim, which is in the nature of an action. Now at this point they're saying, well, maybe we won't assert the counterclaim, we'll just assert the defense. But imagine that strange conundrum where you could defeat a written agreement with an oral agreement, but you couldn't sue on the oral agreement. Neither party could, and you'd be in this bizarre no man's land where neither party could sue on the operative agreement. That
could
can't
it be used for any purpose? I'm trying to think. Could it be used for the purpose of showing bad faith? Could it be used for any other tangential?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. The way that it's been instated in the restatement, which agrees with this proposition, is I think, or maybe it was Amgar, was that you can't allow it for an evidentiary purpose to lead to the direct or indirect enforcement of the agreement. And to the extent that the use that it was being used for would presuppose its existence, I would think it would be impermissible.
So I was going to say the evidence, if there's an allegation of fraud, for example, that could be a separate, totally separate claim against the bank, correct? I mean, rather than used as a defense to the property interest here that's being claimed.
Sure, a fraud claim could be made. And frankly, even in Olympic Holding, this court was confronted with a promissory estoppel claim that was made. But this court was clear to say, while you could make a promissory estoppel claim, you couldn't make a claim based on the oral agreement itself. You couldn't circumvent the statute of frauds that way. I would note that also that, you know, this court has articulated in Shea and even recently this year the presumption of interpretation or stability in statutory interpretation. This is one of those situations. You know, had this court in Finch versus Finch in 1860 decided this issue the other way and said that you could assert this as a defense, a bizarre result, I would submit, but nevertheless, if had it decided that, you know, the General Assembly would have had ample time to correct it. Since the court decided this over the course of the time from 1860 until the present, there have been numerous times that the court has tinkered with little tiny language in the statute of frauds. It is essentially the same beast that it was. It has had a remarkable stability over the last 350 years. But to the extent that the General Assembly had wanted to take issue with this court's decision in Finch, it had ample time to do so and didn't do so. And, you know, Justice Brandeis, as this court has quoted, indicated that the important thing here is to have stability in this court's interpretation. So for all those reasons, I would submit.
What would we write now, Mr. Warren, if we agree with you in the context of your argument? How do we modify what the Court of Appeals has done here?
Well, I think the simplest thing to do would be to reaffirm Finch.
Pardon me, please?
The simplest thing to do would be to reaffirm this court's holding in Finch and reverse the decision of the Ninth District, which, you know, and
is there language in there that's particularly offensive in your view?
Not at all, Your Honor. It's really a very straightforward decision, just rejecting the argument that an oral agreement could be used as a defense. That was a case in which a wife had made.
You just simply think it's wrong.
It's wrong, Your Honor. And this court has decided it. The Ninth District's wrong. Finch was right. We'd like this court to reaffirm Finch.
And so gets us into what I call error correction, because we have an errant court, which we generally don't do, because if everyone understands what the law is, we expect judges to apply it.
Well, you know, this is one of the things that's interesting about Finch, Your Honor, is that it kind of got buried in the time capsule of the last 150 years.
And well, you've got us back with the King's Bench this morning. Talk about buried.
No kidding. But, you know, it was such a this was such a settled principle of Ohio law that it never came up again. And in the cases that we certified a conflict onto this court, as the Ninth District appropriately did, none of those cases cited Finch versus Finch. So I think under normal circumstances, you're right, you know, it's not error correction. But I think this court, it's probably time for this court to reaffirm Finch and remind everybody that this case is out there, decided under the auspices of Chief Justice Brinkerhoff, one of the noted abolitionists at the time. It was a unanimous decision of this court, and we would ask you to reaffirm it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Oshaki. Mr. Oshaki, what happens if we side with you in this matter and the appellate court? What does that do to the requirement that instruments be in writing under these circumstances?
Your Honor, I believe that if the court sides with the appellees in this matter, what it allows the appellees and other similarly situated parties to do is to assert a defense of an oral a subsequent oral modification to a contract. In doing so, the court
counsel,
would...
Counsel, if we begin with that principle that the party should be allowed to raise this as a defense for purposes of 60B, how would you respond to Mr. Warren's point that, well, that creates a situation where you can raise it in 60B, but you can't use it as a counterclaim? So is your next step then that, well, then you think you ought to also be able to use it as a counterclaim?
Well, Your Honor, in 1910, after the cases that Mr. Warren cited, the Ohio legislature defined the term action in revised code 2307.01 as an ordinary proceeding in a court of justice involving process, pleadings, and ending in a judgment or decree by which a party prosecutes another for the redress of a legal wrong, enforcement of a legal right, or the punishment of a public offense. Now, courts, since 1910, courts have used the definition of action to determine whether or not a matter is an action or a matter is a defense.
Should we go back and re-examine that definition in light of the arguments presented this morning?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Should the court go back and re-examine that definition?
I think
in light of the arguments that are being presented this morning?
I think the court should apply the definition to the statute of frauds.
Do you think that it can't be raised as an affirmative claim, but it can be raised as a defense? Is that what you're arguing to us?
Yes, Your Honor. The way that
one side gets to say we orally modified it, but the other side can't.
The other side would have would be trying to enforce the written contract. In fact, Your Honor, courts have used the definition of action that I just cited in similar circumstances. In connection with a Ford corporation, must have a valid license to transact business in Ohio in order to bring an action in a court. However, courts have determined that an unlicensed foreign corporation may defend itself in court. It cannot bring a cross claim. There's cases that say you cannot bring a cross claim, but you can defend yourself. You can move to have the matter stayed pending arbitration.
So I'm not hearing an answer to my question. Does that mean that you could use it as a counterclaim, or are you saying we would be limited to raising it? We would only be able to raise it as a defense, but you would never be able to raise it as a counterclaim. Or are you saying we have to go one step further and also allow you to raise it as a counterclaim?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying that we would be limited to using it as a defense. It would be similar as in a malpractice action, a suit for attorney's fees. Outside the statute of limitations for legal malpractice, the defendant can always use malpractice as a defense. Now, they can't assert the counterclaim, but they can use that as a viable defense.
But we're talking about the statute of frauds here. None of those cases, the corporation issues, those don't involve the statute of frauds, do they?
They don't involve the statute of fraud, Your Honor, but they involve the definition of the term action. And the language that the Ninth District Court of Appeals relied on in its decision in this matter was that the defendants did not bring an action. The defendants raised a defense.
You think the Court of Appeals got it right?
Yes, Your Honor.
But counsel, in order for us to follow that Court of Appeals, we would have to be going against the 10th District Court of Appeals. And I'm reading from the Court of Appeals, and it says, they moved the trial court for relief from judgment, arguing that First Merit was not entitled to recover from them because it had entered into an oral forbearance agreement. Would we not, to side with you, have to determine that an oral forbearance agreement is outside the statute of frauds?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm having trouble.
In order to support your position, doesn't this court have to say oral forbearance agreements are not governed by the statute of frauds?
Well, Your Honor, this is a little different situation than an oral forbearance agreement. At the time,
I'm reading from the Court of Appeals.
Okay, I understand, Your Honor. At the time, there was that the forbearance, this what the Court of Appeals considered an oral forbearance agreement, was entered into. There was pending litigation between the parties, and the Ings's position is that it was not an oral forbearance agreement. It was an oral settlement agreement of pending litigation. The oral agreement that was reached between the parties was to was to stop the foreclosure sale. It was to take the Inkses
thereby making it an interest in land, obviously.
I'm sorry?
Thereby making it an interest in land.
Yes.
It was a foreclosure action.
Yes, Your Honor. It was a foreclosure action. It was a pending foreclosure action. And in the case of...
Well, I'm not, counsel, I'm not trying to trip you. I guess what I'm asking is, are you asking us to find as a matter of law an oral forbearance agreement in a foreclosure action is not governed by the statute of frauds?
Yes, Your Honor, if it is a subsequent oral forbearance agreement while there's pending litigation.
And you, I just heard you say that this was a settlement agreement.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that's what, it's not a forbearance agreement, it's a settlement agreement.
Yes, Your Honor.
But the Court of Appeals goes, their entire opinion is based on forbearance agreement, is it not?
It is, Your Honor. I believe the Court of Appeals, the Court of Appeals, there was a limited record on the matter. It was a 60B hearing. The bank has characterized this as a forbearance agreement.
And so too is the Court of Appeals.
Yes, Your Honor.
They're not saying this was a settlement.
Well, if it was an oral forbearance agreement, it was an oral forbearance agreement while there was pending litigation. And the case I was looking for earlier, Your Honor, Bankers Trust Company of California versus Wright. There was a situation where there was a pending foreclosure agreement. The bank and the homeowners entered into a settlement agreement out of court, and counsel for the bank contacted the court by telephone and said, hey, we've reached a settlement agreement.
Was it in writing?
That settlement agreement was not, Your Honor. What happened is, in the meantime, before the settlement agreement could be reduced to writing, this court's decision in... I think it's Gugliotta came down, and the homeowner said, listen, you know, we've got a viable defense here. We're not agreeing to the settlement agreement.
We're not what?
The homeowners decided they were not going to sign the settlement agreement, and the court had forced an oral settlement agreement in Bankers Trust in favor of the bank.
So if I'm understanding your argument, you think that the letter that First Merit sent to Daniel Inks on March 4th, 2011, with the term statement and Inks' letter back to, Mr. Crummell, constitutes an oral settlement agreement? Is that what you're arguing to us?
No, Your Honor. There were subsequent conversations. There was the issue of the bank, the original agreement that was, the original oral settlement agreement was reached in January. Now, one of the conditions that the bank put on Mr. Inks was...
Well, the term statement came out on March 4th. You agree with that?
There was a term statement, yes, Your Honor. What happened was, the bank added additional terms that were not agreed to in January.
Well, on March 4th, it said the terms that must be agreed to and executed to stop the auction scheduled for Wednesday, March 9th, are as follows, and they listed them.
I agree, Your Honor. After that, one of those.
Think the agreement preceded that, or was it subsequent to this?
The agreement was subsequent to that.
When was the agreement?
The agreement was reached on, I believe it was the day before the auction. What happened is the bank had added an additional $200,000 deposit.
Well, when was it agreed to? Because the letter that your client signed said, I've reviewed the agreement and I have a couple of comments, one of which the actual amount will be delivered tomorrow is $150,000.
Correct, Your Honor. And the bank,
are you saying that was agreed to before this letter or subsequent to this letter?
Subsequent to that letter, the bank said they would accept the $150,000 deposit in lieu of the $200,000.
That was an unrecorded telephone conversation that happened between the parties.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's what you say is the agreement that you're hanging your hat on.
Yes, and the bank's subsequent conduct, Your Honor. The next morning, A bank officer called Mr. Inks at 8 o'clock in the morning, and this is in Mr. Inks' affidavit in support of his 60B motion. The bank officer called Mr. Inks before banks had opened and said, "Where's my money?" Mr. Inks said, I need to get a hold. The $150,000 deposit was coming from one of his new investors. He said, "I need to talk to my investor, find out the mechanisms behind the wiring. I will call you as soon as I speak to him." Mr. Inks repeatedly tried to call the bank officer, and this is in his affidavit in this connection with the 60B.
And all the while, the auction is gearing up, and this is the day of the auction, and nothing was finalized at the time, and the bank says, "Sorry, it's too late. Our negotiations are ended."
No, they had reached an agreement the previous day. Mr. Inks said, "I've got the money." You know, he's calling the bank officer asking, "Where do I send the money?" Bank officer is not returning his telephone calls.
Had he spoken to his investor at that time?
Yes, Your Honor. There's the investor's testimony was entered into the record that he was ready, willing, and able to perform.
Okay, so I'm just getting back to this your statement that this is a settlement agreement, and somehow that characterization differs from a forbearance agreement. And are you saying that you would agree that a forbearance agreement is within the statute of frauds and needs to be in writing, but a settlement agreement does not?
It would depend on the situation, Your Honor. I would say that an oral settlement agreement, while there's pending litigation, does not have to be in writing in order to be used as a defense to the defense.
When it is where the subject matter is technically within the statute of frauds, the property.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. What's the difference between the forbearance agreement forbearance agreement and a settlement agreement?
Well, I would agree that the forbearance agreement, I think they're the same thing. The forbearance agreement was the settlement agreement.
But you just are trying to make a distinction that you can use this oral communication in a settlement agreement, but you would agree in a forbearance agreement it is within the confines of the statute of frauds.
As far as asserting it as an affirmative claim.
No. I'm talking about a defense here, the way you want to use it. Are you saying you can use it in both the settlement agreement and the forbearance agreement?
I would say yes, Your Honor. If
then why make a distinction that this is a settlement agreement or was a settlement agreement and not a forbearance agreement? Which is where you started here. That's the only reason I'm asking you this, because I was interested that you're characterizing this as a settlement agreement, and there's nothing in the Court of Appeals decision that mentions a settlement agreement, and you seem to have been going down the path that there's a distinction between a forbearance agreement and a settlement agreement, and I want to make sure I understand here.
I believe that was one of the issues that was raised in the trial court at the 60B hearing, Your Honor, is the characterization of the agreement.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Warren, you have a minute and 24 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honor. On the issue of the settlement agreement, it was an argument the trial court rejected, and they never appealed it to the Ninth District. I would note that this court in Sherman versus Haynes rejected the argument that an oral settlement agreement that otherwise violated the statute of frauds was enforceable. You know, there is a limited exception if you have an oral settlement agreement that's on the record, if it's been memorialized. I believe in the court that opposing counsel was referencing that actually had a discussion with the court about it that constituted documentation of it on the record. Obviously, we don't have that here. It's a distinction without a difference. And obviously, the discussion about what happened when and what conversations happened when is precisely emblematic of why the statute of frauds exists. And why certainty the application of the statute of frauds is appropriate, so that we don't have to have these sort of who said what and what phone call type of situations when you're having something that involves the statute of frauds. This court has said time and again that the statute of fraud should not be interpreted in a way that would increase fraud or increase the possibility of mischief. We would submit that that's what would happen if the court were to distance itself from its prior holding in Finch, and we would ask the court to reverse.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. We will take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision. Marshall, will you call a recess, please?